Welcome, subscribers. This is William Henry. We have with us today Dr. Rick Strassman. Rick, thank you for taking the time to continue to talk with us.
Well, sure. Thanks for having me.
I would like to focus our conversation, of course, on DMT and especially the idea of parallel universes in conjunction with DMT. But first, I have to admit, I've never experienced DMT, at least not consciously, nor do I have any other psychedelic experiences or experiences with psychedelic substances. But I'd like to, and I have to say I would love to have taken part in your study. But what I want to ask is, how does my lack of experience limit me, or does that, in fact, would you say, in a sense, help to enhance my exploration of this area?
I think, you know, everybody dreams, you know, and you dream. So I think in terms of all of us, you know, having some experience with non-ordinary realities, sort of independent, you know, freestanding, you know, parallel sorts of levels of reality, that all of us, you know, have got, you know, some, you know, firsthand experience with those kinds of states every night that we dream.
Mm-hmm. I had a near-miss experience. Did you ever follow the work of Dr. John Lilly?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Lilly, of course, was a scientist at the National Institute of Health. He invented the flotation tank and to help answer the question, in the absence of stimuli, what does the brain do? And, I had a huge interest in his explorations with the dolphins and the cetacean nation. And I actually met him in 1996 in Denver. He was lecturing at a conference devoted to Zachariah Sitchin. And I have to tell you, I mean, even when he was 80 years old, 80 plus, Dr. Lilly just talked circles around everybody that was there. And incredible. And so I went up to him after his presentation. I said, Dr. Lilly, I'm a huge fan, and I wonder how have you maintained such incredible clarity? And as you know, he was a big proponent of LSD research, and he got kind of a twinkle in his eye, and he says, well, you know, I live in Hawaii. Every morning I get up, I go out on my raft, I take my clothes off, I swim naked with beautiful women and the dolphins, and I take a few hits of acid. Okay. And then he hands me a piece of artwork, this artwork that he had been doing, and it was like a fractal, very colorful, very beautiful. And I get home, and I show this piece of artwork to my brother-in-law, and he starts laughing at me. I'm like, well, you know, why are you laughing? And he says, well, you obviously didn't do acid or LSD in high school, did you? I said, no. He said, well, look at this piece of artwork. It's divided into 900 perforated squares.
Oh, really? And, it was blotter art, huh?
Yeah. So I'm just thinking, wow, this is incredible. He's handing out this piece of blotter art. So I never took the LSD that was or whatever might have been on that piece of art. In fact, I gave it away to someone who was an even bigger fan of Lilly than I am. And it's kind of one of the stupidest things that I felt like I've ever done. I should have kept it. But I had a conversation with another researcher you might be familiar with, James Arthur. Before he died, was a big proponent of psilocybin mushrooms as being the basis for many of the sacred religious traditions.
Correct. Yeah, and, James.
And so I kind of had a little bit of interaction there, and it became just very interested in this subject, because it sort of seems like if we think of our nervous system as a candle and the pineal gland as the wick of the candle, that really none of our candles are lit. How would you respond to something like that?
I suppose it harkens, you know, to the saying that we only use, you know, 10% of our brains.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in you know, the rare enlightened person, either through their own genetics, their own constitution, or through their own hard work, or some combination thereof, they're able to activate more of their brain. And especially, you know, the more spiritual aspects of their brain. You know, the pineal gland has been an area of interest and even veneration, you know, for a long, long time, you know, for thousands of years, ever since it was discovered in the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, So when people speak of the pineal gland, you know, it isn't always that they're talking about the actual, you know, that people are actually speaking of the anatomical pineal gland. They could be more speaking of the spiritual pineal or the corresponding, you know, the corresponding energy, you know, center along the spine, what's referred to in Hindu, physiology as the chakras. Mm-hmm. On the crown, you know, the crown chakra exists right on top of the head, or you know, just under the top of the skull, and a lot of people have made the correlation between it and the actual, you know, physical pineal gland. And you know, I do speculate at great length in my book regarding a possible spiritual function of the pineal gland through its possible, you know, production of DMT. You know, that as I was speaking, you know, earlier, this morning to Whitley, the whole, you know, DMT pineal theory remains only, you know, a hypothesis at this point. There's a fair amount of circumstantial evidence, you know, supporting a role for the pineal in the production of DMT. But still, there are a number of places in the human body that make DMT that's been well established, like the brain and, the lungs. But, I think that people started thinking about like a spiritual pineal gland, or you know, some kind of a crown at the top of the spine, or the top of the human body, that is, you know, mediating deep spiritual experiences. You know, as a result of the kinds of experiences that people have when they're deep in meditation or prayer or some kind of spiritual exercise, in terms of a blinding white light that occurs, kind of at the top of the head behind the eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, so people started, they started looking, for some kind of anatomical correlate, you know, to their inner subjective experience, and they kind of focused on the pineal.
And in the book, you describe the pineal gland as acting like an antenna or a lightning rod for the soul. Could you talk about this and its connection to the 49-day time period of the sexual differentiation of cells during human embryo formation and of the first signs of the pineal gland occurring at 49 days?
Well, sure. Well, that's, so that's kind of known speculation, you know, that's based on, you know, wild-eyed speculation, but
synchronicity.
But still, there is a huge amount of, you know, synchronicity, as you were mm-hmm. saying. So there are a number of different coincidences that seem to, you know, that seem to revolve around the number of, you know, 49 days. In the Tibetan, you know, Buddhist tradition, it's been taught that there are, you know, 49 days between the death of one person and the incarnation of that person's, of their life force or of their, you know, soul into another body. So that's supposed to take 49 days. 49 days elapses from the conception of, of a human embryo until the first appearance of, cells in the human brain that become the pineal gland. It also takes 49 days for the appearance of the male or the female gonads in terms of differentiation between the male and the female gonads, so there is some kind of events that are taking place at around 49 days. The pineal gland is, you know, kind of a spiritual sort of gland, if you will, and it kind of makes its first appearance at the same time, you know, that the gonads do in terms of male or, you know, female gonads. So the reproductive apparatus is responsible, you know, for the physical, you know, continuity of the organism and the species. And if you want to, you know, think of the pineal gland as a spiritual organ, you know, that's involved in, you know, the spiritual continuation and survival of the species. You know, if you kind of place that in the context of the kind of antagonism or the complementarity or, you know, the powerful dynamic anyway, you know, between spirituality and, you know, sexuality, you can start, you know, to make analogies of a conceptual, you know, kind of basis with respect to the anatomical correlates, which are occurring in the human body at that time of development. I do also speculate that, you know, perhaps the entry of the, you know, soul into the body occurs at 49 days of, you know, fetal development, through the pineal gland, you know, which is then, you know, kind of also in some kind of dynamic, you know, tension with the reproductive organs. You know, so that's, you know, kind of in a nutshell, you know, some of my, you know, speculations regarding other, you know, in terms of the 49-day period.
Absolutely mind-blowing, Rick. And, a couple of things. It makes me think of the pineal gland as sort of a stargate for the soul. It comes from elsewhere or else when, and perhaps that is the door or the gate that the soul uses to transition into this world and perhaps even out when it leaves. But I'm wondering, has this line of speculation at all been picked up by people involved in the whole abortion debate? I mean, it would suggest that 7 weeks is the cutoff.
Right.
Have you been approached by people like that? Are they picking up any of this research and using it in their arguments?
Not really, no. I'm kind of surprised, actually.
Me too.
Yeah, I was thinking, well, you know, it's an obscure book. And it's obscure material, but still, you know, there's enough, you know, contained in the book, you know, to stir up a fair amount of arguments, in all kinds of arenas, including the issue of, you know, when the fetus, you know, contains a human soul.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other arguments that you feel like it stirs up?
Well, you know, I'm interested in, you know, somehow increasing the dialogue, you know, between science and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those two institutions, you know, so there are, you know, some journals called, you know, things like, you know, the scientific study of, you know, religion. But, you know, I think if you really, you know, take to heart some of the material that I, you know, discuss in the book, you know, it can, I think, you know, go some ways to starting to, you know, to deepen the level of dialogue, you know, between the two fields. If, you know, if you speculate that endogenous DMT, you know, DMT, which all of us, you know, are kind of carrying around with us at all times, if concentrations of DMT increase in human beings, then they're able, you know, to attain or start, you know, conversing with spiritual realms, ones that contain angels and God and, you know, devils and, you know, demons and those kinds of things. If you can, you know, reliably increase the amounts of DMT through giving it to people, and these kinds of experiences are now available, you know, it would really open up a, you know, systematic, you know, methodical kind of way of you know, scientifically studying religious phenomena. You know, so some people have kind of, you know, picked up on that. you know, the religious, you know, institutions have got a fair amount of territory to hold on to, and, you know, so, mm-hmm. you know, comparably within the realm of, you know, the scientific endeavor. So I think, you know, one of the reasons that the book has not stirred up even more controversy is that, you know, those two groups really don't, you know, want to have a dialogue of, you know, any serious nature, because they'd have to
yeah.
share, you know, they'd have
right.
to share, which is hard for people to do.
Yeah, at least one of them isn't in the business of providing answers. It's in the business of providing hope and keeping people kind of just going on, towing the line, and hope that their professed religious belief is the right one. But what you're kind of intimating here is that there may be an actual process that we can each plug into that will bring about the awakening of our being, but also lead ultimately to a conscious form of dying. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, got, you know, some merit to it, actually. You know, concentrations of DMT do increase with stress, and clearly, you know, when people die, that's, you know, the ultimate stress. And so if you think about levels of DMT increasing at the time of death, you know, that could be, you know, a kind of mediating what most people describe as a near-death experience, you know, kind of mm-hmm. the exit of the life, you know, force out of the body. And if you can give DMT to people, you know, if indeed, you know, concentrations of normally occurring DMT are taking place at, you know, at the time of death, you can give people a kind of a dry run, you know, of for the process. One of the recurring kinds of questions that I've, you know, that I've been getting over the years, you know, pertains to if I've, you know, kind of tested any of the hypotheses that I've, you know, put forth in the book. And, you know, I haven't actually. I've just been uh-huh. kind of doing, you know, my own, my own personal spiritual studies, you know, to try and place endogenous and exogenous DMT into a comfortable spiritual, you know, kind of a framework for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been doing a lot of study of Hebrew scripture and commentary over the last 12 years or so. And I was, you know, kind of hoping in the meantime, you know, that some people in the scientific community, you know, would have taken, you know, some of my ideas and kind of run with them, you know, but nobody has actually. And, you know, so I'm, you know, kind of done with this stage of my spiritual studies for now. And, you know, and since nobody's answered or, you know, even tried to answer, you know, some of the questions that I speculate about, I'm going to start, you know, working on a, you know, super sensitive assay, you know, for normally occurring DMT, so we can measure quite low levels in people that might occur, you know, during near-death states and, you know, psychosis and, you know, meditation, those kinds of things.
Very interesting.
Well, yeah, and, you know, so hopefully within a couple of years we'll be able to start answering some of those questions.
You know, Rick, you Google pineal gland and crystal, and you'll come upon some articles that talk about how the human pineal gland has been found to contain large numbers of calcite microcrystals that bear a striking resemblance to those inside the ear. Could you talk about the significance of those microcrystals and what it ultimately means to our understanding of the pineal gland?
Yeah, I've kind of followed, you know, some of that literature, but, you know, I think what could occur is, you know, a kind of resonance, you know, phenomenon.
Yeah.
Like in terms of those crystals, you know, kind of starting, you know, to vibrate at, you know, at specific types of frequencies through, you know, chanting or through breathing, or through singing, that you can establish a, you know, vibratory kind of pattern in the pineal gland. So that, you know, can have, you know, far-ranging effects on either within the pineal gland itself, if it's making DMT, or throughout other, you know, parts of the brain where DMT is made.
Mm-hmm. You know, Rick, there's a lot of talk these days about pole shifts and energy pulses and radio waves from a mysterious unknown source coming from the center of the galaxy. And coupled with that is a new understanding that beings described in the, or labeled in the Gnostic texts, the early texts from the first and second centuries AD that were written by some of the followers of Jesus and the other members of that early Christian movement, they describe these archons in exactly the same terms that we describe the grays today. Mm-hmm. And play tic-tac-toe here, you also, in your book, describe beings that people experience as a result of DMT, and they seem to match with the archons that are described in the ancient texts as well as with the grays. And here's the intriguing thing to me. What we're told is that these archons, as well as another group of beings described as aeons, were emitted from the center of our Milky Way galaxy. And so it's curious to me that here we have this mechanism in our bodies, the pineal gland, and this substance, DMT, that is involved with trans-parallel dimension travel or interaction, apparently, and that it's also capable of receiving through this process of resonance, maybe even signals coming from the center of the galaxy. Have you, in any of your research, come upon anybody commenting on the relationship between the beings that they were seeing in the center of the galaxy or anything of that nature?
No, not really. No. I mean, that's the short answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I get quite a bit of email still. You know, the book came out almost, you know, 6 years ago now.
Right.
Yeah, but I, some people do, you know, get, you know, back to me about, you know, some of their, you know, celestial ideas regarding the beings and DMT, but I'm kind of hard-nosed still in my own kind of crusty Jewish way, and it's a little hard, you know, for me yet to be able to think much about, you know, things from the, you know, middle of, you know, of the galaxy, because it still kind of, you know, begs the question, where did the galaxy come from, and, you know, in what kind of a structure is our galaxy kind of embedded in, you know, so it gets pretty huge, and I have a hard time, you know, focusing on one specific area, perhaps in the world or in the universe where this stuff comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to, you know, kind of keep expanding the perspective as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. I'm just intrigued by the correspondence as well that you had with David Deutsch, who wrote a book on the fabric of the universe as well as parallel dimensions. And at that time, he doubted, you were talking about the possibility of awareness of parallel dimensions, and he doubted that this was possible because it would require quantum computing. And this was out of the question at the time you wrote your book. I'm wondering if you knew that just a couple weeks ago in February 2007, a Canadian company is put on the market or up for scientific scrutiny a device that they claim is a commercially viable quantum computer, saying that they have accomplished something that scientists didn't think would be viable for another 20 to 50 years.
Yeah. Well, so David Deutsch, you know, was kind of talking about quantum computing requiring extremely cold temperatures,
mm-hmm.
you know, but still, I mean, you can always, you know, fiddle with materials, you know, for things that have to, you know, in some people's minds occur only in specific kinds of very cold temperatures, you know, to make those, you know, phenomena occur closer to room temperature. You know, superconductivity was always believed to only be able to occur at very, very cold temperatures, you know, but they've got, you know, materials now that are able to demonstrate that at almost room temperature, you know, and so quantum computing, I think, is, you know, turning out to be kind of comparable. It can occur at room temperatures as well. You know, so the human brain is obviously much more complicated, you know, than any kind of, you know, than any computer anybody could conceive of. you know, so limiting it being able, you know, to perform certain, kinds of operations only at very cold temperatures is, kind of hubris, as it were.
But it goes to this idea of increasing our computing power so that we will be able to create and affect virtual worlds within our own world. And it's really interesting to me, too, that getting back to those first and second century Gnostics who referred to those archons, they said that the number one power that these archon beings possessed was the power of simulation that they called hell, through which they could create a synthetic holographic world, literally a virtual reality world. Does it surprise you that the ancients would talk in such detail about the existence of this or other worlds, and that it seems to match what the DMT journeyers experienced in your experiments?
Yeah, that's curious. Well, in scripture in the book of Genesis, in terms of the description of the creation of man, it's spoken of that humans are created in the likeness of God. And there's been quite a lot of speculation as to what that means. And one of the commentaries describes that as in terms of man being a creative entity that he can make things. That is one of the functions of the angels too, in the Hebrew Bible, is that they create, they're kind of the messengers of manifestation. So, if you look upon it in a comparable kind of fashion, these archons, could be looked upon as angels, as it were, spiritual beings that are then able, to create. So there are some analogies there, it seems.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that this kind of goes to, we're made in the image of God. One of the questions I'm so intrigued by, Rick, and maybe you can help me with it, is what is a fully functioning human being from your perspective as a biological psychiatrist? We have a body that is literally a manufacturing plant, if you will, that's capable of synthesizing or manufacturing these various substances that can produce these astonishing experiences and connect us with other worlds, but yet typically we don't use that capability within us, at least not in a directed way. So what would be a model for a fully functioning human being for you?
That's a good question. That's one I think about a lot, especially within the context of the existence of endogenous DMT. What does that, mean in terms of the ultimate outcome of human evolution?
Mm-hmm.
I've been corresponding with somebody who's quite interested in Kundalini research,
mm-hmm.
and so there was a and a number of years ago there was an Indian scholar named Gopi Krishna who had written quite a few books about Kundalini, and he speaks about Kundalini as an evolutionary kind of force, and if Kundalini is activated in human beings, that would so that would usher in the beginning of a new stage of human evolution. And I myself am still, struggling to understand what Kundalini is, and if it were activated in all people, what would the structure of human society look like?
Mm-hmm.
And I think obviously it would be a it would be a culture of enlightened people, you know, so they wouldn't be, you know, killing each other. You know, they'd be thanking God and, you know, they'd be praising God all the time. And it also makes me think about, well, is, you know, the ultimate evolution of human beings, you know, is it going to take place in our bodies or not? And, you know, DMT, you know, kind of entrance into non-corporeal realms. And, you know, all of us contain a, DNA, that codes, you know, for the enzyme that makes, you know, DMT in our bodies. You know, so I've speculated or, you know, I've kind of mulled over the possibility that perhaps our ultimate our ultimate stage of, you know, of evolution, isn't going to be limited, you know, to the body anymore. It could occur, you know, somehow, through some species-wide or, you know, existence-wide flash of DMT, you know, that's stimulated, wow, you know, through some kind of aberration in our chromosome. Yeah. And that kind of, you know, kind of pushes everybody over into the next, you know, level of existence.
Did you ever see the movie Men in Black, the flashy thing that they would use to erase everybody's memory?
Yeah, kind of like that.
Kind of like that. That would be cool. Rick, in True Hallucinations, Terrence McKenna talks about his exotic research adventures in the Amazon drinking ayahuasca, which also contains DMT. And after drinking or taking ayahuasca, he says some shamans were able to see a substance that is described as violet or deep blue that bubbles like a liquid. He says that when you vomit from taking ayahuasca, this violet fluid comes out of your body and it also forms on the surface of the skin like sweat. And these shamans are able to look into this substance and see other times and other places. Have you ever heard any reports like that in any of your studies?
Well, you know, in the studies I did, I never heard reports like that. No. And I've, you know, met and talked with a number of people that have drunk ayahuasca, and I haven't heard, you know, that specific, you know, description of what happens under the influence. But, ayahuasca is a profound, you know, healing, you know, substance, and it's capable of taking people anywhere, I think. You've never taken ayahuasca, have you?
No, I have not. I'm kind of beginning a quest to seek it out, though. I have read numerous books about it, including Graham Hancock's recent book, and I'm highly intrigued by it.
Yeah, it's an incredible substance. If in the future I ever actually, you know, resume giving, you know, people drugs, it would be ayahuasca. It's an orally active, you know, form of DMT. You know, so it's a lot more manageable. Its duration of action is, you know, is close to 6 hours or so, as opposed to just a few minutes of IV DMT. So I think it's capable of being, you know, worked with on in much more fruitful, you know, kind of manner than the smoked or the IV DMT is.
Right. Well, Rick, we've come to the end of our time here. I wish we had a few more hours to walk through some of this. Your experiences are absolutely incredible and invaluable, and I hope that maybe the listeners will pick up your book and start getting in touch with the research scientists that they know and the spiritual people that they know, and hope to build a bridge between those two worlds, because I certainly agree with you that bridge is, I think, what's going to enable us to cross into the higher level evolution of our species. So thank you very much for taking this time.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again. This is William Henry. Thank you, subscribers, for listening. Catch up with you next time.